It's still dark when you wake, when the early signs of sunrise sneak through the curtain. You wipe your forehead, you're sweating, your pulse is racing. You take a few deep breaths to calm yourself down, but it doesn't help. The dream you had was vivid and disturbing. You roll over. Your husband, the man you followed to this backward town, was already up. He always got up early. His time in the military was ingrained. You could take a man out of the Legion, but never the Legion out of the man. You struggle out of the sheets. They're soaked in sweat and tangled around your ankles. You walk down the hallway, bumping into the walls. You hear sounds of the slaves getting the house ready for the day, but it doesn't register. You finally find your husband. He's doing his morning stretches. He's been inventing a new sort of exercise which burns your core. He thinks he might name it after himself, but you're not sure if Pilates will really catch on. Perhaps Pilates. In any case, there he is, strong and stern. Ever the man you fell in love with. But a troubled man with his own demons. The grey stubble on his hard jaw makes him look even more intimidating than usual. You guess intimidating is the right word. To everyone else, he is a vicious man. But to you, he is just your husband, the man you love, who you know will listen to you. Honey, you croak, still waking up, the images of your dream still floating before you as clear as the sight of your beloved. Pontius, please don't call me that, he replies. Okay, but you need to listen to me. Can it wait? I'm halfway through my toe taps and just about to start the plank. I'm going for a PB this morning. No, it cannot wait. Well, make it quick. I have a busy day. Yes, about that. I had a dream.
A dream?
What was it about? It was about that man.
What man?
You know who I'm talking about. The man they say is the king of the Jews.
Who says that?
Some say that, but you need to promise me something. He sighs and walks up to you, laying his hands on your shoulders. Only then does he seem to notice the look on your face. I would do anything for you, you know that, so long as it does not interfere with...
You cannot kill him.
Excuse me? You must not kill him. Promise me. Jesus, the man they call the Messiah, the Christ. You must pardon him. You must leave him be. You must have nothing more to do with him. Why are you saying this? What's going... Just promise me. Promise that you, Pontius Pilate, governor of Judea, will not crucify Jesus of Nazareth. Welcome to the Isms and Schisms podcast. I'm glad you're here. It's great to be back. If I've timed this correctly, and honestly, I've probably dragged my feet a little bit, so I probably haven't timed this properly, but this should be somewhere around Easter time, or shortly thereafter. So I thought we'd do a couple of Easter-related episodes. This episode is about one of the more enigmatic, unknown characters in the Passion narrative, a man who was ultimately responsible for Jesus' death, but not much is really known about. That man is Pontius Pilate, the Roman Emperor's representative and governor of Judea. He is the man who invented the exercise Pilates, which he named after himself. Okay, that's not true, but he was the first person to fly a plane, which is why people who fly planes are called pilots. That's not true either. The truth is, we don't really know much about him at all. We know a little bit. Enough to know that he was a violent, brutal man, and yet the Gospels and early Christian literature take pains to show that he was not all that bad. A man who was manipulated by the Jewish leaders, backed into a corner, didn't have a choice, and felt great remorse afterwards. Realistically, this portrayal is probably inaccurate. In reality, he probably didn't give a second thought about Jesus and slept as well that night as he had ever had. He was probably pleased with Jesus' execution. So why did the early Christians present him as someone who really struggled over Jesus' death, whose wife had a dream, who symbolically washed his hands to demonstrate his innocence. We'll get to that in this episode. But first, just as a reminder, I would really appreciate it if you left a review or a rating. Apple and Spotify are the best places to give a star rating or leave a little comment, preferably something nice, of course. But those sort of reviews help the podcast get out to people who haven't heard it before. It would really help me out. Thanking you in advance. So, who was Pontius Pilate? The names Pontius and Pilate were family names. We don't really know his first name. And he's kind of the only, or one of the only, white guys with any significant dialogue in the whole Bible. There might have been a couple of others, like Cornelius the Roman centurion, or the philosophers in Athens who Paul debated with. The Roman soldiers wouldn't have been. They were likely conscripts from neighboring nations. There's not really any white people in the whole Bible. Now, of course, the concept of whiteness didn't really exist at the time, and our concept today is largely derived from Northern European ancestry. In fact, people didn't tend to make a big deal out of skin color. It didn't really matter what you looked like. If you weren't from my tribe or clan, I probably didn't like you. And if I could, I'd probably enslave you. Sorry about that. At its peak, the Roman Empire had 40 provinces, each requiring their own governor. And we know almost nothing about any of these governors, and there were lots of them. They were important people, but not quite important enough to have lots of stuff written about them, except for Pilate. While we don't have a great deal of information about Pilate, we know more about him than any other governor. Mainly because of Jesus. Pilate is mentioned by Josephus, Philo, and Tacitus, three important non-Christian historians of the time, and his name was found on a rock excavated in Caesarea in the south of Judea. We get from the Roman historian Tacitus this important piece of information. Christus had undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilatus, and the pernicious superstition, in other words, that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah, was checked for a moment, only to break out once more, not merely in Judea, the home of the disease, that is, Christianity, but in the capital itself, where all things horrible or shameful in the world collect and find a vogue. Pilate might have been a Roman equestrian of the Samnite clan of the Ponti, an ancient warrior clan of southern Italy, or he might have been from the kingdom of Pontus on the southern coast of the Black Sea in modern-day Turkey. Or the name could have been from the word Pilatus, which means spear. So perhaps his parents were javelin throwers, or maybe they were javelins. Though he also might have been born in Rome, and he probably fought in the campaigns of Tiberius and Germanicus in northern Europe. Pilate became governor, or prefect, in the year 27. You had to be 30 to become governor, so we could assume Pilate was approximately 30, and it was quite a prestigious job. He served for 10 years, which is a long time for a governor, so he was probably quite good at the job. He would have been in charge of about 6,000 soldiers and a couple of million citizens. Finances took up most of his time, worrying about the many taxes that the Romans enforce upon its citizens. Pilate had the power to appoint the high priest, and he appointed Joseph ben Caiaphas, who was the high priest the whole time Pilate was governor, and who gets a regular mention in the Gospels. Caiaphas was closely associated with the Sadducees, who represented the powerful and wealthy upper echelons of society. So Pilate had allied himself with the social and financial elites, which politically makes sense and shows that politicians have always liked making friends with the rich and powerful. He did some things that were quite offensive to the Jewish locals. For one, Pilate erected Roman standards in Jerusalem. These were gilded shields, and they offended Jewish law. When the Jews protested, he refused, and it took the emperor himself to get Pilate to remove these standards just to keep the peace. Historical records show that Pilate was a brutal, violent man. The role of governor was a military role. Their job was primarily to suppress the locals and keep them in line. They were chosen for demonstrating skill on the battlefield. They didn't really have much experience or skill in actual governing. They were there to squash riots. At another time, Pilate brought some busts of the emperor into Jerusalem. Again, a large number of people protested at his house. He had his soldiers surround the crowd, but when the Jews showed that they would rather die, he relented. He saw how important this sort of thing was to them. But did he learn? No. Another time, he ransacked the temple treasury to construct an aqueduct. Again, people protested, and this time Pilate had soldiers dress in civilian clothes with weapons hidden behind their clothes and mingle with the crowd. They then attacked the protesters, and many were killed. His name is known by many, of course, because of what is written about him in the New Testament and his role in the trial and execution of Jesus. So let's turn to the Gospel accounts. We do see some development in the narrative, from the earliest Gospel, Mark, through Matthew and Luke, and then John. In each successive Gospel, the story is elaborated upon and lengthened. Each evangelist adds their own little flavor to the story. This usually is an indication that some creative license has been taken in each retelling. Increasingly, from Mark to John, the Gospels tend to show Pilate as rather weak, one easily pressured and backed into a corner, which is quite different to what we know of Pilate from other sources. I'm interested in why this cruel Roman would receive such a favorable portrayal by early Christians. We are first introduced to Pilate when Jesus had been arrested and dragged before Pilate. But before this, the Gospel of Matthew includes a little cryptic moment between Pilate and his wife, which is not present in the other Gospels. There's one verse that mentions that Pilate's wife had a dream. Matthew 27:19 has her saying, "Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." Nothing is really known about Pilate's wife. She might have been named Procula or Claudia, or Claudia Procula, or Longina, which I think I'm mispronouncing. And in some Eastern and Ethiopian traditions, she is revered as a saint. It's likely that Pilate was married and that his wife accompanied him to Judea when he became governor, even though this was not normal practice. Wives didn't normally come with. Because of this cryptic little reference to her having a dream, which doesn't really tell us anything except that it disturbed her, stories developed around her and Pilate. Some apocryphal texts say that they even became Christians. Now, the dream is almost certainly legendary. It's not mentioned in any other gospel, and it's unlikely that the author would have known about her dream, and it was a common literary trope in Jewish literature to have a noble pagan woman side with Judaism. So I don't think it actually happened. I'm more interested in why this little reference would be included in the Gospel. It seems to me that later authors wanted to rehabilitate Pilate, portray him as more sympathetic toward the Jesus movement than what he probably was in reality, in an attempt to blame Jesus' death on the Jews. By doing so, the burgeoning Christian movement could distinguish itself as the people who recognized the Messiah, over and against the Jews who rejected the Messiah. But we'll return to this idea after we've explored the narrative a bit more. Pilate had the right to order execution without trial. Pilate's predecessor ordered that 200 Jewish insurrectionists be crucified all at once and immediately, and they were. But with Jesus, Pilate wanted to be careful, especially at that time of year, around Passover, when Jerusalem was incredibly busy. Tensions were high, and the smallest little thing could cause big headaches. So it's not improbable that a trial would have happened, especially considering that Jesus did have a following. But I do think the Gospels exaggerate the size and significance of the trial, how many people came to watch, and indeed how much Pilate actually cared. Jesus is dragged before Pilate by the Jewish leaders after giving him their own special treatment of beating and humiliation. Here Luke mentions the entirely fabricated accusation that Jesus was trying to get them to stop paying taxes to Caesar. Pilate asks, "Are you the king of the Jews?" To which Jesus replies in a very characteristic way, "You say so." And Jesus then remained silent, even though Pilate was giving him the chance to defend himself and was greatly amazed and possibly quite frustrated by Jesus' silence. Luke makes it much more explicit that Pilate could not find any guilt in Jesus, which John makes even more explicit. In John, Jesus is not silent, but says, "You say that I am a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth." To which Pilate says, "What is truth?" I love that that question is included here. It's such a heavy philosophical question. I'll be doing an episode on postmodernism soon because I find this very question really interesting. But what stands out to me here is that the Greco-Roman conception of truth is generally quite different to the Hebraic idea of truth. The Greco-Roman view is the basis of the modernist Western conception of truth. It's very objective and abstract. But the Hebraic understanding was much more relational and dynamic, which is precisely why Jesus could say that he was the truth. So there's a real clash of culture here. But then it's not really elaborated upon. Pilate asks this bombshell question that would cause so many headaches 1700 years later, and then the narrative immediately moves on, as though the author thinks, oof, that's actually too big for now. Let's just move right along. But there is a real irony as well, because the author presents Jesus as the truth. Pilate is staring him in the face and dares to ask, "What is truth?" In John's Gospel, Pilate seems to catch a glimmer of that truth. He's convinced that Jesus is innocent. Yet the Jews, who are also still in the room with them, they too are staring right at the truth and completely miss who Jesus is, and they tell Pilate to kill him. But there's another loophole that Pilate can appeal to. The Gospels say that there was a tradition where Pilate would release a prisoner at the Passover feast, a way of trying to convince everyone that the Romans were in fact merciful and benevolent. So Pilate asks if he should release Jesus. But they all say no. They actually want another prisoner named Barabbas to be released. This person had been involved in an insurrection, possibly the same insurrection that Jesus may also have been involved in. So Pilate says, "Well, okay, I'll release this murderer instead of Jesus. But what do you want me to do with Jesus?" "Crucify him." Ultimately, Pilate thinks it's not worth the trouble. Who cares? Let's get this over and done with. And he gives us one of the most iconic images of this narrative. He washes his hands, a symbol of his innocence. And this symbol of washing one's hands remains a common idiom to this day. Pilate hands Jesus over to the Jewish leaders to do as they pleased. Now, there is no historical evidence of such a tradition of releasing prisoners on Passover ever happening, either by Pilate or really anyone else. Though, as mentioned, we don't really have any evidence of Pilate doing anything. So just because it's not recorded elsewhere doesn't mean it didn't happen. But it does seem like a strange thing for a Roman governor to do. Perhaps it was an attempt to keep the peace. But the Romans pretty much always came down really hard on matters of law and order, especially when it came to potential revolutions and uprisings. If Barabbas was an insurrectionist, I find it, honestly, a little bit difficult to believe that the Romans would just let him go. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. It probably doesn't really matter either way, but I think it was included in the narrative as another attempt to emphasize the unjust nature of Jesus' crucifixion and to shift the blame from the Romans to the Jews. The Romans were giving so many opportunities to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept insisting that he be killed. Jesus is given multiple opportunities to defend himself, and Pilate repeatedly says that Jesus is innocent. In fact, Pilate is the only one who stands up for Jesus. But he's been backed into a corner. John even says that Pilate becomes more and more afraid. He's powerless and scared. He symbolically washes his hands and gives Jesus to the Jewish leaders to do with as they like, to be judged by their own law. I find much of this portrayal of Pilate to be improbable. Pilate was known for being ruthless, and the Romans were not known for submitting. It's baked into their national psyche. Never back down. Never surrender. Rome always wins. They were an incredibly proud people, and the law always trumped any other law or custom. Roman rule was absolute and was backed up by the most organized and fearsome military force in the ancient world. A Roman governor of a backward town like Jerusalem being afraid of, or even submitting to the locals, would have been abhorrently disgraceful. Exceptions were made, but not to this sort of egregious level. I just don't think Pilate would have been intimidated in the way the Gospels make him out to be. Pilate's normal way of doing things was to literally beat people into submission. And he didn't really care about local customs. Again, some allowances were made here and there, but only when it didn't impinge upon Roman law and order. In general, it's the Roman way or the Roman highway. And they were very good at building highways, most of which led to Rome, apparently. They were very good also at enforcing the Roman way. Plus, crucifixion was really only a punishment that Pilate could hand out and was reserved for slaves, bandits, and traitors. Pilate's whole job as governor was to repress any uprising. So he would have had Jesus crucified because he believed Jesus to have been an insurrectionist. I highly doubt Pilate would really have cared about Jesus' guilt at all. It would have been an easy decision for him and could well have been his initiative from the very beginning, not the Jewish leaders. And so Jesus was crucified at the command of Pilate, who saw Jesus as just another troublemaker, one among many who needed to be dealt with harshly and quickly. A few years after Jesus' death, a Samaritan man declared that he was the reincarnation of Moses and earned himself some followers. They went up on a trek up a mountain, and when Pilate heard about this, he believed that they were planning an armed uprising. So he sent in the cavalry and slaughtered them all. The Samaritans complained to a Roman legate, who was of a higher rank than Pilate, who ordered Pilate to go to Rome and explain himself to the emperor. So he was recalled to Rome, but Caesar Tiberius died as Pilate was making the journey. And we don't know what happened to Pilate from then. Various apocryphal texts include legendary stories about Pilate, many of which express Pilate's remorse at having condemned Jesus. One of these is called the Book of the Cock. The Book of the Cock, as in the chicken, obviously. Here, Pilate actually gets into an argument with Herod, trying to convince Herod to not execute Jesus. Pilate's daughters are deaf and are miraculously healed by Jesus. And so they all convert to Christianity. Jesus reassures Pilate that he does not hold him responsible for his crucifixion. This is, of course, entirely fictional. A pretty major issue concerning Jesus' crucifixion is how unjust and unfair it was. Not the doctrinal concerns of Jesus bearing the sins of humanity, something we'll discuss in a later episode, but that Jesus didn't really do much to deserve execution, let alone crucifixion. You'll often hear that in evangelistic sermons, the preacher stirring up an emotional response. However, this is overstating the issue. To a Roman at the time, there was nothing unjust about Jesus' crucifixion. They did way worse to others for way less. Let's be clear. Torture is always unjust, as is execution. Jesus did not deserve what he got. But he's not entirely blameless either, at least within a first century Roman legal code. Jesus was a troublemaker, possibly an insurrectionist, a threat to the stability of the region. Pilate was a brutal Roman governor whose sole task in Judea was preventing an uprising. Crucifixion was a common means to scare people into submission. Jesus' crucifixion was, by no means, extraordinary. To the common folk, he was just another disgruntled idealist who got in with an extremist group and felt the mighty hand of Roman rule, like so many times before him and after him. From a Roman perspective, Pilate's decision to have Jesus crucified was laudable. For a Roman, it was a good thing. But what I'm really interested in is the attempt to rehabilitate Pilate. With each successive gospel, Pilate is portrayed more and more as a weaker and weaker governor who gets bullied into submission by the Jewish leaders and who regrets Jesus' crucifixion. Other early Christian texts defend him even more, showing more remorse, even becoming a Christian himself. Why? No one liked the Romans. Pilate was violent and represented the Roman presence in Judea. So why present him in such a favorable way? I think the main reason there is to blame Jesus' death on the Jews. There was increasing tension between the Jews and this emerging Jesus movement. And we see this animosity reflected in the later texts of the New Testament. There's even a couple of points where the Romans save the Christians from the Jews, which is all the more surprising considering how books like Revelation talk about the Romans as the Antichrist, the beast, the harlot of Babylon, the great enemy. Jesus was the Jewish Messiah who was not accepted by many Jewish people. So by transferring blame for Jesus' death from the Romans to the Jews, it emphasizes this point. It distinguishes the Christians from the Jews as the ones who truly recognized and welcomed their Messiah. In the 4th century, when Christianity was not only acceptable and legal, but was becoming increasingly socially expedient, this was reversed a little bit. And in the Nicene Creed, it is stated explicitly that Jesus was executed by Pilate. But the damage had been done. And ever since, the idea that the Jews killed Jesus was an idea that the Jewish people could never shake. All sorts of horrible things have been done to the Jewish people, justified by the belief that they killed Jesus. But let's remember that it was the brutal, imperialistic Romans who did it. Within the Roman legal code, Jesus' crucifixion was legal and justifiable. Pilate's presence in the Gospels is a reminder of the shadow cast by Roman imperialism over the life of Jesus and of the early church. This context shapes the contours of how we understand Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. It is the context of imperialism, colonialism, tyranny, oppression, exploitation. These are all expressed in various ways in the 21st century. Indigenous rights, environmentalism, poverty, racism, corruption. I don't need to list them all out. I'm sure you are very aware of everything. As Christians, these are the sorts of things we should be concerned with. And, like Jesus, are the sorts of things we should stand up to. That's it for this episode, the first proper episode of 2024. This week was about Jesus' execution, but next week will be about his resurrection, namely the symbolism of his being raised on the third day. Hope to see you then. Not that I see you anyway, or do I? No, that's too weird. This episode was recorded on the traditional lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. I look forward to examining more isms and schisms with you.